Well, good morning, everyone.
Welcome to our teleseminar on understanding and engaging under reef students with co-author Carla Crotel from Youngstown State University in Ohio. I'm Peggy Conrad, Vice President of Publications at AHA Process, and I really want to thank each of you for joining us today. We are so pleased to be starting more conversations with colleagues in higher education, and we know how busy you are at this time of year. We hope this teleseminar will provide you new understanding and effective strategies for engaging your students that you can immediately use in your workplace and make this hour call really count for you today. Before I introduce you to Carla, let me go over how our teleseminar will work. Know that Justin has already muted the phone lines so that everyone can hear clearly. Some of you have questions in already. And after Carla shares information with you for about 30 minutes or so, I will ask her the questions on our list. And if you think of more questions during this call, we do invite you to email them at any time to questions@ahaprocess.com. That's questions@ahaprocess.com. And we will incorporate them as best we can into our Q&A session at the end. And we plan to be finished within 1 hour. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our presenter today, Carla Crotel. Carla is Director of Youngstown State University Metro Credit Education Outreach, where she helps create and deliver programs for underserved populations. Carla holds an undergraduate nursing degree from the University of Pittsburgh, as well as an MBA from Kent State University. After being a charge nurse on inpatient psychiatric units, a program coordinator in county health department clinics, and director of a regional lead poisoning prevention program, she joined Youngstown State University staff as a grant writer, workforce development program director, and research associate in the Center for Urban and Regional Studies. Under Carla's direction, YSU Metro Credit was an early adopter of Getting Ahead for college students, and has already trained over 300 college and technical school students in the Getting Ahead concepts. Their efforts began as a grant-funded workforce initiative, using Getting Ahead as a stepping stone for low-wage, low-skill workers that wanted a better life. An unforeseen twist of fate revealed just how powerful Getting Ahead can be. Carla, who was coordinating the project, received a promotion that resulted in grant participants receiving very little support or follow-up outside the recruitment into Getting Ahead workshops. Nevertheless, over 58% of the participants, who were largely minority women with high school education, completed another educational program after the Getting Ahead intervention. And during a six-month period when the actual coordinator was on staff, the figure jumped to 70%. In addition, 50% of the students in YSU's first Getting Ahead class remain enrolled at YSU, making academic progress 2 years after the course. These results prompted further research, resulting in the book, Understanding and Engaging Under-Resourced College Students, as well as a new edition of Getting Ahead, which will be used in post-secondary education, due out later this year. So, Carla, we are so delighted to have you with us today, and now the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Peg. That was a very nice introduction. Hello, everybody, and thank you for spending part of your day with us. There are at least 40 states represented by the registration for this teleseminar, and I think that's evidence of the feeling of urgency among us in higher ed to do a better job training and educating first-generation low-income college students. I recognize the names of many of the people on today's registrations, and I know that these people are already knowledgeable about Dr. Ruby Payne's Framework for Understanding Poverty and Phil DeVall's Bridges Out of Poverty, which provides strategies for professionals in the social service and related sectors. But many of you are new to this information, so I'm going to give a little overview of what we mean when we say under-resourced students and why it's so crucial for us to craft programs of support but also demand, and why such programs need to be fundamentally different than what we're doing today. I'll conclude with some ideas about how to craft such a program. So the plan is that I'll talk for about a half an hour and then answer some questions. For simplicity's sake, I'm going to use the term college to refer to the whole continuum of post-secondary education and training programs that go from short-term, non-credit certificates to degree programs. And I'll take some little pauses between sections to let you gather your thoughts and send along any questions that you have. I hope that sounds okay. And let's go.
Carla, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I had someone send me an email that your voice is really soft on their line and they're having troubles hearing you. So it'd be helpful if you could speak up a little.
Well, thank you for that feedback. I was trying not to put on a professor voice for you, but is this, whoever sent that along, please send us in some more feedback, and if it's not working out, we'll do something else, okay? Okay, so the first question to ask is, why is this so important? And one answer is that there's been significant research into educational outcomes based on economic class, and another is that there are powerful interests deciding what needs to be done about those outcomes. My feeling is always that practitioners such as yourselves develop much better solutions than researchers and policymakers, so we need to get busy. There was a fellow named Bourdieu who said, "Statistics are human beings with the tears wiped off." But honestly, these stats bring tears to my eyes. Nationally, about 25% of all of our undergraduates fall below 125% of the poverty level. Low-income students, and especially first-generation low-income students, 52% of them enter community colleges, but 32% of those drop out after their first year. Nationally, 42% need remedial classes, and that percentage can go as high as 90% in some schools. 6 years after enrolling, only about 30% of low-income first-generation students retain a certificate or degree. This is staggeringly poor performance, and it's linked to many, many things that we can't control. But I do believe that by addressing the impact of economic class head-on with the students, many of the needs that they have and the barriers that precipitate their failure can be met. Well, here in Ohio, the state is changing the state subsidy formula to reward colleges for retention and completion rather than just recruitment and enrollment. We're real good at getting them in. We're just not so good at getting them out. Now there's a financial incentive for colleges to do a better job. So while poverty is taking its toll on individuals, and students from poverty take their toll on institutional performance, there are other ominous shifts for higher education to consider. Economic and workforce development people want higher skill levels faster, and the accreditation bodies want more student engagement and expedited time to degree. This highlights the tension between people, educators, who provide technical and professional education that leads to jobs and careers and economic development versus those that promote the development of critical and creative, practical and reflective thinking skills that inform individual choices and prepare people for meaningful civic participation. So we think that there's a sound curriculum and a pedagogy that addresses these increasingly disparate demands. And what I love so much about the work we're doing is that it does accelerate skill acquisition. It does develop critical and creative and practical thinking. And it can be used to create a level of student engagement that's relatively unprecedented so far. So the second question is, what is an under-resourced student? And before I answer that, I'd just like you to do something for me. And that's to picture in your mind a college student from generational poverty, what you think you know about them, why their life is the way it is, and what they ought to be doing differently. Now, please let that all go. Just let that drift away and suspend your belief system for a half hour here so that there's room for a new way of thinking and a new perspective about this very important topic. Ruby Payne and Phil Duvall describe 11 resources for people that have, 11 resources that people have to one degree or another in their lives. And UNICEF first defined poverty as the extent to which one does without resources. So the 11 resources are obviously financial. But beyond that, you have physical resources, emotional resources, your ability to react and control your reactions. Mental or cognitive resources is your ability to think and your ability to apply learning to new situations. Spiritual resources, relationships and role models, support systems, motivation and persistence, integrity and trust, language, which is a huge resource in college, and knowledge of the hidden rules, which we'll talk about in a minute. So it's pretty easy to grasp the idea that poverty is the extent to which you do resources, the extent to which you do without resources. And we all probably know someone with strong faith and family and community that's doing pretty well despite a generational lack of income or accumulated wealth. But most often, that chronic financial poverty erodes the other resources. And as that happens, it becomes harder and harder to get out or to get ahead. As one of my students said, poverty sucks, and it doesn't do much good to romanticize it. People in generational poverty get trapped in the tyranny of the moment. The baby's sick, the car broke down, the little sister has a court date, all sorts of things happen. And when there are very few resources, it takes much longer to solve those problems. So a lot of the time gets spent dealing with these crises and issues that are caused by a lack of resources. And it's very difficult to step back and think abstractly about long-range problems and planning and papers that are due and forms that need to be filled out and all the other things that we need students to do in college. So students come to us without a lot of information. They don't have that intergenerational transfer of knowledge about college that you get from parents and brothers and sisters that went to school. They come with poor language skills, remedial and reading and writing and oral communication. And they come with very few champions, not many people that are 100% behind their success and that are also able to contribute to their journey. And they also come with rather concrete thinking and reactive problem solving into an incredibly and increasingly abstract world of paper, internet, emails, Blackboard, classrooms, and so forth. So let's take a little break here, and I'll grab a sip of water, and you can send in any questions you might have.
And Carla, I just got one more email from someone who would also appreciate if you would talk just a little bit louder.
All right, I'm going to take a little look at this phone here and see if I can do anything to it. Hang on.
Okay. Thanks. One thing I might say to listeners while she's checking the phone, if your connection isn't good, mine is fine, that doesn't mean yours is, but if you're having trouble hearing, one thing that might help is to hang up, try and dial in a second time. You might get a clearer connection on that second try.
And I'm sorry, I'm seeing a mute button and a redial button and a speaker button. An intercom button, but I'm not seeing a volume button on this handset. I will try to keep my voice up.
That sounds very good right there.
Okay. All right, so one of the defining characteristics of Ruby Payne's work that we've taken to the college campus is this concept of hidden rules. And hidden rules are those unspoken cues and understandings of a particular group. The hidden rules at a Baptist wedding are different than those at a Catholic wedding. And if you behave according to the rules of one group and you're amongst the other, you're going to get that look. It's not because one's right and the other's wrong, but it's because people hang with their own groups and they expect you to know the rules if you're hanging out there too. So let's look at a common situation that gets played out on campuses all the time through the lens of the hidden rules of economic class. Okay, there's a major assignment due. The student did not hand in the rough draft as was instructed, and the day the paper is due, they're absent. When they come to the next class with the paper, the instructor points out that it's late and that there was no rough draft, and so the student's going to lose 10 points right off the bat. The student laughs. The instructor reacts with something to the, along the lines of, hey, if you don't want to take school seriously, you're going to fail. The student probably doesn't ever return to class. Well, what's going on here in terms of hidden rules is a clash between the hidden rules of middle class and the hidden rules of poverty. First of all, the driving force behind the hidden rules of poverty is relationships. When you don't have a lot of other resources, relationships are vital. It's how you can get things done. If you have to choose between helping your mother get your grandma to the nursing home or coming to class, you're going to help mom, because tomorrow you're going to need mom's help. If there's not much of a relationship with the teacher, it's even easier to blow off your class, and you're not inclined to pour your heart out to the instructor if you don't have that relationship with him. You just take care of your business. Now, the driving force for the middle-class instructor is achievement through work and school. If mom needs help managing grandma's health care, then that's going to get planned out on the BlackBerry and set into a busy schedule of events and commitments and work and all those other things. So you say, yeah, but the student knew that this was coming. Well, you know, maybe not. In middle class, we have the ability to have a time horizon of about 2 to 4 years out. And it's expected that one's going to plan for future and consider what you need to do in a kind of a logical order. And education is considered very important, and it's not unusual for somebody to leave their relationships with their family behind for a while, go back and get that master's degree or that PhD. In poverty, things are pretty shaky. The present is the most important, and the decisions that are being made for the moment are oftentimes driven by relationships and the need to survive. Education is nice, but there's not a long history of success, and there's not a lot of point in planning because things rarely work out. And so students come without much practice in planning. So then the instructor delivers a consequence for the lateness of the paper and the lack of the process in terms of the rough draft. And the student laughs in his face. Well, the middle-class instructor has hidden rules about power and destiny. He expects a certain amount of respect due to his position, and he expects negotiation, and he expects the student to take responsibility. The instructor knows that if the student made better choices, they would have a better future. But the student from poverty doesn't feel a sense of power, and he can't stop bad things from happening, and there's not much point in trying. There's not much a person can do to mitigate fate. The student laughs to diffuse the tension because of the lack of respect that he's feeling the instructor is giving him, makes him want to poke the instructor in the nose, and he's not going to do that. So what's the use of dreaming and planning if you don't have the means to get there? Now, before you send that email, no, I am not suggesting that the instructor accept late papers, unexcused absences, or disrespectful behavior. But if these expectations are approached differently, with a different mindset, and methods that account for the differences in hidden rules and resources, and with an understanding and respect for what under-resourced students do bring to the table, a much more positive series of events might unfold. Now, there are at least 15 major areas where one can observe significant and meaningful differences in the hidden rules for the perfect college student, and we don't have time to get into all of that today. But once you've mastered an understanding of these concepts, it can really help you rethink your programs and retool them without lowering the expectations. We must maintain high expectations and academic rigor. We don't do anybody a favor by passing them on if they're not meeting the standards. But we can offer support in ways that are much more meaningful for the under-resourced learner. You see, our programs and our institutions are the archetypal example of middle class. There's just nothing more middle class than the average college campus. Harvard and Yale aren't average, and that gets into the hidden rules as well. And when you look at those rules, that's when you realize that fitting in with people from different economic classes has much less to do with how much money you have or don't have, and much more to do with your understanding of the hidden rules. Okay, so how do you go about teaching students about these hidden rules? And what are you going to do about their language skills and the disconnect between a kind of concrete, reactive world and what's being expected by the college environment to earn a credential? Well, I think that whether you're a student services professional or an instructor with a specific discipline, that we've got some concrete and useful teaching and learning strategies that can help students master those expectations. And it's interesting to see that the techniques are equally useful in a financial aid office or in an economics course, in a developmental composition course, or in a peer mentoring or tutoring kind of session. We'll take another break. How are we doing on volume here?
I think it's good. I've gotten some emails to that regard as well. Justin, does it sound okay to you?
Yes, yeah, ma'am, I can hear you just fine.
Great. I think we've solved that problem.
Okay. Well, if you're familiar with Dr. Payne and Sildoval's work, then you probably memorized a quote from Connor that says, no significant learning occurs without a significant relationship. And for students from generational poverty, relationships are one of their driving forces. So if you can establish relationships of mutual respect, you can really create and foster more motivation for learning. It's pretty critical for under-resourced college students to develop bridging social capital. That's a term that was coined, I think, by Robert Putnam. You've got bridging social capital when you've got relationships with people that are not the same as you and that have achieved the kinds of things that you want to achieve. These are people who can help you figure out the hidden rules and link you to the resources to help you get to your goals. Being bridging social capital for students does not mean that you have to love everything the student does and does. In fact, it's just the opposite. Students know when they're being thrown a sop, or when a teacher is accepting a subpar or plagiarized work, or when tests are ridiculously easy to pass. And they don't respect that, and they really don't like it. There's a guy in California at a community college, and he produced a documentary called Reading Between the Lives. And it's fascinating to hear the students talk about teachers. You know, one kid saying he got an A in biology and never bought the textbook. We can't let that happen. So anyway, back to bridging social capital. To be bridging social capital, you've got to demonstrate support, insistence, and high expectations. And that's another mantra in this work. So here are some practical methods to make that kind of environment. And some of the researchers behind it are Moustakas, Brookfield, Marzano, and of course Ruby Payne. And basically, these are things that good teachers already do. But even if you're a good teacher, you can be even more effective with under-resourced students if you become more intentional about these behaviors and really consider your curriculum and where and how you might be able to demonstrate your support, insistence, and high expectations. Well, one way you can demonstrate support is by directly teaching the processes of your course and using mental models. And oh my gosh, it must have taken way longer at this than I thought it was going to take. I'll try to speed it up. So you want to be explicit about how the course is organized, what the purpose of the activities and projects are, and demonstrate your own willingness to learn from the teachers, so that from the students, so that they kind of feel that sense of respect from you. Show concern, obviously listen carefully, and try to listen for what motivates them to reinforce that. If you can find something out about the student, what their personal interest or passion is, and acknowledge that and demonstrate some recognition of that, that can really help. Insistence is about the motivation and persistence that comes from the relationship. To foster this, you want to be consistent in what you say and do what you say you're going to do. Our students aren't going to trust you. Hold the students accountable to themselves and to the group. You can be a coach and an advocate by helping them understand their encounters in light of the hidden rules and help them get connected to the resources that the campus offers. And if students are not from a dominant culture, provide access to individuals who attain success and maintain connectedness to their roots. The notion of high expectations is summed up in the phrase, I know you can do it and you will. Don't dumb it down, don't lower the bar. Have high expectations of yourself as well and avoid undermining your own credibility in an effort to affirm the student. So what we're going to do next is take a look at a couple of teaching and learning strategies in light of the Getting Ahead College Edition Curriculum Workbook, which is in the process of being completed and published. And it's a revision of Duvall's original book called Getting Ahead in a Just Getting By World. And we just specifically are tailoring it for use by a college audience. This curriculum provides a means of understanding individuals and society through the lens of economics class. It develops cognitive skills and other resources that enable students to experience college-level success early and envision a new future story for themselves. The students investigate research on the causes of poverty, the hidden rules of economic class, resources for a stable life, and there's an intentional theory of change that's put out in front that supports personal growth and engagement in the learning process. We have found that students respond to this curriculum even more strongly than people do when we've used it in the community context. College students from poverty are a select audience. They're already on the bus. They're already trying to make changes. And they instantly recognize the relevance and the value that this information has for them personally. You have this like instant engagement with the subject matter. It's also important because aside from developing resources and skills, Getting Ahead College Edition also addresses head-on that differentness that many students from under-resourced backgrounds face in higher ed. It's unique in the relevance of the subject matter, and it directly teaches those tacit knowledge bases. So the curriculum basically works through a group process of sequence co-investigations, assessments. There's a lot of discussion and debate in class, reflection papers, the development of mental models, and trying to get students to move from concrete thinking towards a more abstract thinking and then back to concrete planning. So with that overview of Getting Ahead in mind, we'll talk about the more practical research-based strategies that support learning. And I'm trying to kill two birds with one stone here, talking about the strategies in light of the Getting Ahead curriculum. But they are they stand on their own just fine and can be used with any discipline. So mental models I've mentioned a couple times, and that's a concept that our mind uses mental models as a way to hold information and depict connections and to sort information and to predict events. Mental models can be drawings or stories or analogies, cartoons, even physical movements, and they can be used to represent concepts or processes. They're especially helpful in collapsing a large amount of information and expressing it in a very short time. So television weather reports are a great example of how mental models can quickly transfer a ton of information about the structure and processes and patterns of the weather systems. It would take a lot of words to talk about everything that a map can show us in seconds. Well, here's an example of a mental model depicting the European Reformation. So picture a cross, like a block across, okay, torn in half lengthwise down the middle. On the left arm of the cross is the word people, on the right, the word king. On the left side of the cross is the word state, on the right, church. On the left is the word science, and on the right, religion. The cross is torn down the middle. And that mental model could really help a student hold all that information in their head for a test or to write an essay. So in Getting Ahead, students do this whole series of mental models, and they keep returning to them, which introduces the concept of what we call rolling revision, that learning is rarely done, and that as you get new information about a subject, you go back and you revise what you thought you knew before. We also advocate using graphic organizers like mind maps or concept maps to help students make the associations and connections and to frame perspectives or concepts. I was going to try to lead you through the development of a mind map related to the causes of poverty that would show the rise of the middle class, but they are, after all, graphic organizers, and that just might not be a great thing to try to do on a phone call. I don't want you to feel terribly frustrated. But, in Getting Ahead or in any college class, there's all this content, and the graphic organizers really help students see the connection, say, between education policy, like a GI Bill or child labor laws or free public education, and the ability for people to get that education and get better jobs and attain a middle-class income.
And Carla?
So process maps, like mind maps, they map the procedures, and it shows you a starting point. What are the inputs, what are the outputs, and what are the ending points, and those kinds of things. And again, in Getting Ahead, the stages of change and the assessment processes that are used really benefit from process mapping. But so can chemistry classes, so can the financial aid process or the student appeals process.
And Carla, what I was just going to insert here, I was looking in the book, Understanding and Engaging Under-Resourced College Students, some of these mental models you're talking about, the one for Reformation, If people have this book, it's on page 267 in the appendix with quite a number of other mental models that are demonstrated throughout the book. I just thought people might like to know that.
Great. Thanks, Peg.
Sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay. That's good. I forgot there was that book out there, you know. And then lastly, I'll just talk quickly about learning strategies. Trying to make up the gap in vocabulary and reading and writing skills is really important. And so from the first meeting in any course, and especially in Getting Ahead, you can get the students to start building a lexicon. And you can call it a lexicon because it gives it this nice formal title, and when you talk about it, then they're going to always know what you're talking about. But it gives you a word list of terms and concepts that are used in the course to describe the constructs and the processes and the content of that course. And adding to that lexicon builds vocabulary and fosters word consciousness and promotes that shared meaning and understanding, which is very important. As the semester unfolds, students recognize when and how the lexicon words are getting used. In Getting Ahead, students use that new language first to build an understanding of their individual stories and then to reflect on issues and assign meanings to external events, which is a much higher level of cognition. It's fun, and when the instructor recognizes the student's use of words from the lexicon, the student gets some validation and affirmation, which is good for that relationship. The concept of wide reading describes that sort of extensive reading on a given topic that results in multiple exposures to new vocabulary. And the research shows that students are going to pick up a lot of vocabulary just from reading, and the more that they see the words appearing, the more that they're going to pick up. So in the Getting Ahead book, there's a ton of suggestions for additional reading. But no matter what you're teaching, you know, if you can point students to particular readings that relate to their special interests. For example, you know, short stories or novels about people from that individual's own background. That active recognition is a really nice way to demonstrate your respect, your recognition of what's important to them, and to build those relationships. So just like in the case of using additional readings, instructor has to decide how much or how little emphasis to put onto writing assignments. And in the Getting Ahead workbook, we use journaling to elicit and shape the stories and the wisdom that students bring to the classroom, but that they haven't found a way to talk about yet. And the assignments are offered with the assumption that the instructor is not a writing instructor and that Getting Ahead is not a comp class, but it could be. So there are, regardless of your discipline, there's a couple of practical strategies for responding to student writing, and this would be in freshman-level classes early on. You don't want to be doing this with a junior-level student. But we advocate for you to ignore mechanical errors the first half of the term, or maybe more. If you can refrain from editing and pointing out the punctuation and spelling and grammar and usage errors, you can focus more fully on the act of writing rather than the mechanics. Those usage errors are paralyzing to students. What's more important is that they come to realize that they have ideas to express and that they're able to express them. Then the grammar and syntax becomes relevant because students want to share their ideas and their writings. And they realize that in order to be taken seriously, that people also, that the paper also needs to be grammatically and syntactically sound. It's also very interesting to use student writing as a text. You have to be sure to get names off and not use passages that identify the students, but it really helps ground the work in the real world and let students see progress and real examples of what works. You can read it aloud, you can provide printed copies or whatever. But here again, we use this technique of the lexicon and developing labels and questions that become familiar for the students to use over and over. So, for example, if a writing sample, say, it starts off like, are you a person with plans and dreams of your own? Do you reach for the stars? If so, then Getting Ahead's personal planning process is for you. So then the teacher would ask, you know, how does this sound? Does this remind you of anything? Where have you heard that sort of talk before? How would you label it? And one of the students might get around to saying, well, it sounds like one of those Ronco commercials on TV that's trying to sell you something. So that voice then can be labeled in class as the Ronco voice for the rest of the term. And when the instructor writes Ronco in the margin, the student automatically understands exactly what's being meant. That Ronco voice sums up a great deal of abstract information. Now, there's a couple of other ways, things you can do there. You know, if a student writes something like, by working hard and doing the right thing, my family made it out of poverty. Well, that you could call that magic dust. Or being a student means different things to different people. You could call that a golly gee whizism. Or it was wrong for me to watch TV instead of study. That's a bad guys, good guys kind of statement. We say the student pinned the tail on the donkey when we see the conclusions that don't conclude or just stop or dodge. And there's warm-up pitches for introductions that don't really introduce. Yeah, what's your attitude so that you don't come off as if you're making fun of the student, but rather you're building a lexicon and building that understanding of what authentic writing is at the college level and what it's not. There are a lot of other questioning techniques and things that you can do with writing, but basically, again, if you can use a couple of questions effectively and repeatedly, the students begin to use them themselves and apply them to their paper before they hand them in to you, which really helps. They start to think about their own thinking and their own writing. Okay, well, I promised to talk for about a half an hour and then answer some questions just as they came in. There's a lot more to this, of course, both in theory and in practice, but I hope that you got some flavor now of the differences between this way of understanding students and this type of curriculum and pedagogy, as opposed to the more common ones that seek to build skill sets and dispense advice and prescribe solutions. Those might work all right with middle-class students, but students from poverty really need much more. So we're looking for like-minded educators who would like to be part of a community of scholars to share information about this kind of work and these strategies. So please don't hesitate to get in touch with me or the other authors if you are interested. So let's check first to see if we have any questions. Peg?
Yes, I do have a couple questions, and I'd just like to mention one more thing before I ask you the first question. While you were giving some strategies, I know how much people appreciate those. I was just going to point out to our listeners that in Chapter 5 of this book, we actually have about 45 pages of strategies. I realize you could only talk about, a few this morning, but we certainly... the work is strategy rich. So I was just going to, I wanted to mention that. And looking at the questions, one question is, tell us, what makes you convinced and what makes you think this actually works to do this?
That's a good question. We've been asked that before. Well, Youngstown State University is an open enrollment university, so we take anybody regardless of their educational level. So right now, we're 1 month into our fall term, and we've retained the students in the Getting Ahead course. In the other non-Getting Ahead reading and study skills and developmental type courses, there's often as much as a 50% attrition rate by this point in the term. So they're coming to class, they're participating, and they're submitting 2 to 4 page journals every week. It's amazing. The students that we worked with in 2007, as we mentioned, 50% of them are still in school. And these are students with reading levels below sixth grade that are trying to come to college. After one of the planning exercises we did, a student wrote in her journal, "I never realized how much of my day gets wrapped up in other people's problems. It's dragging me down, and I can't do this. They don't care about my college." That's a pretty powerful insight for the third week of classes, and this happens over and over with each student each week as they just uncover all of this abstract information about their life and how they're going about it. So it works by doing two things right away. It instantly engages the students in the subject matter, and it's instantly relevant. I mean, who doesn't want to learn why they're in the economic class they're in and how to do better? Early on in this work, everybody thinks if they win the lottery, they'll be okay hanging out with the rich people, but it's not that easy, you know, and especially if you're in poverty. And secondly, it gives students a successful college-level experience and a positive peer group to support their efforts right off of that. If you can get them into something like this first-term freshman year, it stays with them during their whole career. Our students don't stop getting together at the end of the semester. They keep on meeting informally, and that would lead to the engagement piece, which is a little bit more than we want to get into today. But it's pretty unique to see that kind of reaction from some first-term freshmen. Okay?
Okay. Another question is, how do you suggest people work with administration or the hierarchy in their institution to implement something like this? I know you described this very carefully in chapter 7 to 13 in this book, but tell us a little bit about it now.
Well, it's going to depend a lot on the culture and the hidden rules of your institution. But pretty much you've got to find a champion that's got some credibility. I was fortunate enough to gain a position at YSU where my job is to serve under resource populations. So if you can get somebody involved, that's good. You have to get good at a little elevator speech on this topic, what you can say to an administrator real quickly to see if they get it, because people either get this or they don't. There's not a lot of middle ground. So when you find the people that get it, collect them. And make a committee. You know, you don't have to ask for permission. Whoever's there can get the work done. So get them together and develop a strategy. We had some grant funding that enabled us to pilot Getting Ahead, and now the data coming back from that is speaking for itself. So that is helpful. And another thing is to, if you can get a Getting Ahead group through, to develop a student advisory panel of Getting Ahead graduates. Those students are hard to ignore, and we borrowed this from the Bridges community because we found that in the community setting, having people from poverty at the planning table really cuts through a lot of BS and posturing by people that maybe don't want to change the way we're doing things. I don't know. I don't want to speak for Bethany Tucker and for Karen Tucker, but we could also model ourselves after what Phil Duvall does. He works with communities, and when he does a workshop, he'll frequently make himself available the night before or right after the workshop to do a short, high-level session with the administrators and foundation people, you know, the people that won't sit through a whole workshop. Mm-hmm. And those people appreciate that time, and they're usually pretty high-level thinkers, and so they can get the concepts pretty quickly, and then you can get that buy-in. So we could probably do that if somebody was interested. Okay?
Okay. How do you think this relates to other coursework that, say, first-generation or low-income students might be already involved in at the university? I'm thinking like the Learning Center courses or...
Yeah, this is really adaptable to credit or non-credit programming. What we've been doing to create a lot of synergy is we adopted a learning community model where we put Getting Ahead in, paired it up with a developmental English composition course. And the professor for that course developed a custom reader of excerpts and articles that are related to class, to race, to language, and to education. And it ties in beautifully with Getting Ahead, and his assignments resonate back to what's in there. So you can do that with all sorts of introductory level courses, but especially writing courses or reading and study skills courses or, you know, the college success orientation type of courses. Mm-hmm. Of course, the teaching strategies work anywhere, so that part's easy.
Okay. I have two questions that I'm going to give you at the same time. Someone named Jim sent this one in about resources. He's asking, he says his school makes an effort to provide opportunities for students who can't afford them normally, in the past, local clubs have contributed thousands to their efforts, and with the economy, things like clubs are suffering and can't necessarily supply their normal level of support. And wondering whether, you know, in looking for, you've obviously figured out how to fund this, or you might make suggestions for people on how to fund an effort like this, and whether you have suggestions for other resources that may be more recession resistant, or you know, just some thoughts along those lines. And when you talk about funding.
Yeah, sure. Education is really, really hurting with the state economies being what they are. I don't know about recession-proof funding, but Jim, if you figure that out, let me know. That the foundations and things are also just being deluged with requests for funding to fill the gaps for the cuts that people have taken from the state sources. I think, you know, if you're looking for grant funding, there's a lot out there, particularly for community colleges, or if you can relate what you're doing to workforce development-oriented kinds of things. Even if you're not a workforce person, does what you want to do prepare people to work? If you can craft your message in that way, then your local Workforce Investment Act agency might be willing to use some funding. Locally, the Workforce Investment Act folks have gotten a lot of stimulus money to try to work with the unprecedented levels of unemployment. You know, Youngstown has the distinction of having the highest unemployment in the state of Ohio, so it's really been amazing to see the numbers of people and the new unemployment that's happening. But also, you know, look at the federal grants. Those can be a little difficult to get. Foundations like the Gates Foundation, the Lumina Foundation, the Kellogg Foundation. But for a local initiative that's, you know, getting local kids out of the county and into a broader setting, I think that you were going to the right sources. Maybe you can find a new way to ask, or even bring your graduates of that experience into a little advisory group and ask them, you know, why this was important to them and why this should be continued, and find a way to take the message that's directly from the student back to those donors that have been good to you in the past. But, you know, to implement these strategies and educate your teaching staff and your faculty and your student services people, or if you want to start working with Getting Ahead, you know, if you can afford a day of professional development for at least your core team, but hopefully as wide an audience as you can, so you can get the buy-in, you can get this off the ground and consider the idea that you already have the money to do this. It just needs to be redirected. Our university spends a disproportionate amount of resources on underprepared students, and we don't do that good a job historically. So why not try something new and promising, pilot it, gather the data, and, you know, then customize it to your students. That's the approach that most of the schools that have begun to adopt this have used. And it's kind of a stealthy, quiet approach, but it seems to be working.
Well, Carla, I don't have any more questions right now. If there's anyone who has a question you'd like to email in the next minute or so, we'll be glad to ask it. But while I'm waiting for that, let me thank you so much, Carla, for being on the call today. I really enjoyed hearing about what's happening at Youngstown and how those of us in other places can apply it. And what I wanted to tell our listeners is that to thank you for being on our call today, we have a special offer. If you would be interested in booking a workshop on understanding and engaging under-resourced college students with one of our co-authors, and call and contact us about it today, we'd be delighted to offer, Carla has offered, that she would host quarterly conference calls with you and other higher ed institutions also doing the same thing during the next 12 months. So we invite you to contact our office either on our either on our 800 number at 800-424-9484 or just send an email at to questions@ahaprocess.com sometime today. And the only qualification would be that the workshop would need to be held before the end of March 2010. I know that those conference calls we hold for Bridges trainers can be so helpful, sharing results and ideas and advice. It really carries people along, not having to reinvent the wheel. And for those people who have not seen one of the Understanding and Engage in College resource books, we want to tell you for the next 24 hours, if you go on our online store and use the code COLLEGE923, books would be available at the quantity price instead of the full price during the next 24 hours. So, Justin, do you have any more questions coming to you?
Well, Peg, I have a real quick question.
Yeah.
You know, in higher ed, things move really slow. I don't know that anybody would be able to commit to a workshop today. Do they just need to contact you, or do they have to actually book something?
Yes, actually, just make the contact today and talk to us about it. I realize I didn't say that very clearly, but if you initiate the contact today, that's what is required. And then we just need to hold the workshop by March 2010.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. And I think we've agreed that those quarterly conference calls would start in January. So that
sure. That sounds good.
That sound good? Well, I don't see any more questions, but Justin, if you wouldn't mind sending a follow-up email after this call, Carla has offered her email address, and mine is there as well. We'd be very happy to hear from you about further questions. And other than that, I think we're done. Carla, I really thank you so much for being here. Do you have any final comments?
Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure. We love talking about this stuff and sharing the information. So I appreciate everybody's time today, and I hope to hear from you. Please email me. I'd love to hear what you're doing. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.